The health of Maine's bats. Bats are everywhere this time of year. Not real bats, of course, but Halloween decorations meant to spook and scare young people. Unfortunately, though, real bats are scarce these days. White nose syndrome, which is caused by a fungus, has wiped out most of the bats in Maine. Some estimates put the mortality rate since 2007 at 96%. And that's a big concern because bats play a vital role in our ecosystem, eating tons of insects, including mosquitoes. I'm Jennifer Rooks. It is National Bat Week, and today we'll discuss efforts to protect the bats remaining in Maine and help their population flourish again. We'll also learn what to do if you have bats in your attic, and we'll address some of the myths about these flying mammals. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Bats are not always seen in a positive light. They are linked to Halloween because of their scary image. But these small flying mammals contribute to the balance of our ecosystem. Today, as part of National Bat Week, we'll discuss what's being done to protect their population and answer your questions about encountering bats in your surroundings. Joining me in the studio, Chevanelle Webb. She is a fur bearer and small mammal biologist with Maine's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Dave Yates, a wildlife research biologist with the Biodiversity Research Institute. And Mark King is a bat biologist and organics management specialist with Maine's Department of Environmental Protection. He also works with helping people with bat problems in their homes. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a question about what to do if you've been close to a bat? Are you wondering what's happening with white nose syndrome? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I'm so eager to find out about what's happening with white nose syndrome. I'm going to back up a little bit first, Dave, though, because tomorrow is Halloween. Why do bats have such a bad rap?
I don't know. You know, probably because they're cryptic, they fly at night, people don't know a lot about them. But, you know, I think overall, if you look at Hollywood movies, things like that, you know, they're always portrayed in not the greatest light. Let's just put it that way.
So. Right. And one of the myths I understand is that bats get tangled up in people's hair. Right on the IFNW website, that myth is dispelled. Chevanelle, why do people think that bats get tangled up in hair?
I guess, you know, in movies and whatnot, that's been portrayed for a long, long time. And that just continues to get perpetuated. And there's so many falsehoods out there. You know, blind as a bat, not true. And other, you know, the fact that the bats kind of swoop as they fly. And so people might think that the bats are swooping to attack them, but that's just naturally how they fly. So I think if you understand the ecology more about bats, you'll start to appreciate the positive side of things.
I read it's possible that you may be, because you're warm on a cool night, attracting insects, and the bats are coming for the insects.
Definitely.
That are attracted to your head. I've never had that happen. I've never had a bat swoop in my head. So, Mark, walk us through the different kinds of bats we see here in Maine and also some basics about them.
Okay. Well, we have 8 species that are thought to exist in Maine. The most prominent ones that people would see in their homes or used to be are the big brown and the little brown. They tend to like human structures to have their maternity colonies in. And then we also have the northern long-eared bat, which is on the endangered list. We have the eastern small-footed bat, which is a very cool animal. And we have the tricolored bat, which also, when back in my day when I was studying them, it was called the eastern pipistrelle. And then we also have the hoary bat, the red bat, and the silver-haired bat.
So the eastern small-footed, you said, is a really cool animal. What makes it cool?
They tend to sort of make colonies and hibernate in talus slopes, and that's a really neat study that IFNW is working on right now.
Okay, and the talus slopes are at Acadia National Park, correct?
That is one of many talus slopes that we're studying. Currently, this past winter, we've got 5 sites that we're honing in on that we've documented bats using the last 3 winters, and we're using really special acoustic detectors that can record bat calls. And in the wintertime, when we expect bats to be hibernating, we've actually found so bats are coming out of these talus slopes for whatever reason. So it's kind of exciting to see non-traditional hibernacula being found.
Okay, the first big word of the day, hibernacula, and that is a fancy word for where bats congregate to hibernate. Dave, the last time I saw you was 6 years ago, and I was fortunate enough to accompany you on a expedition into a hibernacula in winter to check on bats. That day, it was not good news. We found very few bats, right. And the bats we found had white nose syndrome. So for those in our audience who have not heard of white nose syndrome, explain what it is and why it's so devastating.
White nose syndrome is a fungus, basically that was brought, or at least we believe it was brought probably on cavers' gear or somebody's gear from Europe or Asia. It landed in New York in about 2005. 2006, somewhere in that neighborhood, and around Albany, New York, as far as we could tell. There were probably about four or five isolated caves that we had found that first year. Maybe it was the second year that we had actually found it, but we thought it was the first year. And it spread from there, basically from biologists at first, not knowing that they could spread these, you know, spores from cave to cave. They were panicked, basically, why are all these bats dying? What's going on? Running around. And then after, you know, lab tests came back, they honed in on this fungus that that was Pseudogeomyces destructens is what they called it. And since then, it's killed millions of bats across the United States and into Canada, and is slowly moving west, or has moved west, has arrived in Northern California, Washington, Oregon, possibly British Columbia.
And the way, I'm trying to remember, the way it affects bats is that they can't survive their hibernation in the winter because they were not able to store up enough fat?
Yeah, correct. You could imagine, a 8-gram animal has not a lot of fat stores through the winter. And normally in the winter, a bat during hibernation might arouse and wake up maybe four times during the winter. What's happening with bats with white nose is it's multiplied, say, by 3 or 4 times. So they basically come around January, they're depleted their fat reserves and water, and will fly out of the hibernacula looking for food and water in the middle of January. And in Northeast, there's snow on the ground usually, and there's no insects and no available water. So they basically end up starving and dying. And basically, the fungus is waking them up out of hibernation because it's itchy, basically, is the best way to describe it.
So it's itchy. They're waking up. They're moving their body, and they're using up that precious fat reserve. Chevanel, this is why we just mentioned the talus cliffs a minute ago. This is why it's important, right? Because what we understood about bats before is that they would go to these hibernacula, these mainly caves, but also maybe old mine shafts, places like that, and then they would spread this white nose syndrome because there'd be so many in the same place. Now, that's not necessarily the case with these new places we found that they may go in the winter.
So bats may have always been using talus slopes. We don't know that. So basically, the hypothesis is that these areas of talus slopes basically were created when part of the mountain fell down, and then you've got a collection of rocks creating these underground cavities. So essentially, this is what bats are using.
So talus is when you see a big heap of big rocks piled up.
Right. And in Maine, we're a rocky state. We have rocks everywhere. There's no shortage of rocks. And these talus slopes, from what we found with our research studies, is everyone is unique. So some of those rocks are the size of softballs. Some of those boulders are the size of cars. So there's been huge variability in where bats are using these sites. And we're hoping to hone in on what specific features. Is it slope? Is it aspect? Is it size of the rock, which could potentially create those underground cavities? What exactly are those features that are creating enough of those temperature and humidity conditions that bats need? And so we're hypothesizing that potentially if these cavities are smaller than what a normal bat cave might look like, that we have fewer bats congregating. Fewer bats means, less chance of disease transmission. And maybe these talus slope cavities create conditions where that fungus doesn't like to grow either. So there's a lot of different ideas. And we are, when we catch bats for this study, we are checking them for white nose syndrome and checking the environment as well to see if that's in the environment.
What are you finding so far?
So that remains to be seen. It's been extremely challenging catching bats coming off talus slopes because you got to know what point in the rock they're coming out. So we actually have a scent dog team out right now today checking out talus slopes. So this is a dog and a handler team. They're from Washington. They flew in last week. They're here for 3 weeks, and they're going to be traveling all over the state. We've got some sites in southwestern Maine near Porter, Camden, Acadia, Clifton. And that dog and handler are going to go, basically just kind of walk across the slopes very slowly, methodically, checking for holes of scent.
So a special bat-sniffing dog.
Yes. His name is Jack. He's very cute.
Is he a lab, a German shepherd? What is he?
He's a blue heeler mix, and he's been specifically trained on scenting bats, live bats. So he went to Alaska in August, and he found over 80 points there. And then we were lucky to have them fly out and try their luck here in Maine as well. And they've been to several sites already, have been finding holes where bat scent is coming out. And we found fresh guano, which is a fancy name of bat poop. We found last week on the rock at one of the points where the dog had scented bats.
So this is good news, it sounds, and pretty encouraging after a really discouraging decade.
Definitely. There's a lot of hope out there.
All right. I want to talk to you, Mark, about what happens when someone gets a bat in his or her attic. You know, despite this terrible news about fewer and fewer bats being out there, I'm still hearing stories of friends who have bats in their attic. And, you know, people are sensitive to the plight of bats. They don't want to kill them. What does one do?
Well, the first thing they do is they contact either the Department of Agriculture or one of the pest services. And they go out to the house and they look for physical evidence, and they'll go up in the attic and they look for bats hanging or guano on the floor. Once they do that, then they usually either give me a call or have another bat person come and do what's called an outside vigilance. And that's where we go outside in the middle of the night, just about dusk, and we place people at all the corners of the house, the north, south, east, and west, and we look for bats emerging to go out and feed. And they usually like to have their roost entrance facing south, southeast, or southwest. And we count the number of bats that come out, and then I let them know whether it's a big problem or a little problem. Most of the time in Maine, we're finding that we have the little problem where there's five or six or seven, and it's because those bats actually live somewhere else, and they're coming to that place to roost at night. And so we call that a night roosting behavior. They come in, they digest, and then they leave again to go somewhere else. So it's really just a process of attrition. Once I find out where they're getting out, I just, you know, wait till the bats leave and we seal those areas up.
And there's a proper time of year to do this, correct?
There sure is. Bats mate in the fall, and in the spring they're pregnant and they come to these roosts to raise their babies. So we don't like to do anything until after the third week in July, once all the bats are volant, the young are flying. And because otherwise, if you trap the young inside, they're apt to come down into your kitchen. You know, you find them in your sink because they're thirsty. So we just try to do it afterwards. Or if people are really patient, I wait until the first or second week of October, because then they've left for hibernacula if they're the little browns. But if they're the big browns, they might prove to stay in the house over the winter
as
well.
They might use your attic as their hibernacula. So, you know, here we are on October 30th. We're kind of past that window now.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, if you think you have bats in your attic, you ought to maybe let them live there for the winter.
That's great advice.
And they're not going to move around and make a lot of noise.
Not at all. And, you know, the damage that they do is not as scary as the olden days, where I went to one roost back in 85 with Bob Martin where there were 1,500 bats. And they had done a significant amount of damage.
In one person's home?
In one person's home. And they had done a significant amount of damage. And it was just, you could smell it. That's one of the things when I go in someone's house, I can get up in the attic and smell, and I can tell immediately they have bats. They have a scent that's, the guano has a smell to it.
Our producer, Cindy Hahn, thought she had squirrels in her attic, and it turns out they were not squirrels, they were bats.
That's right.
They walked along the floor, though, in a way that sounded like something else.
Right.
Yeah.
So some people have barns and they're more than happy to allow the bats to stay in their barns. And bat guano is actually really great for gardens. So some of our traditional, like historical sites that had a lot of bats in them, you know, quite a bit of guano would accumulate and people would scoop it up and throw it in their gardens. And it was kind of a win-win.
I want to ask, and maybe I'll throw this one to you, Dave. I know all three of you know the answer to this question. Talk about the importance of bats to the ecosystem.
Yeah, you know, I just think, you know, I always like to kind of tell the story that, you know, bats are the birds of night, right? And, you know, as Chevenel and Mark had talked about how we could use acoustics to, you know, tell what species are out there and things like that. Well, if we could actually hear at night, it would sound like a chorus of birds singing out there, flying around and things like that. And so intrinsic importance, I think, is one. You know, it's just, I think, just for me, you know, I just love bats and I like seeing them around. I mean, now there are other important issues. And you know, I think one of them is the economic importance of bats. And when it comes to agriculture, it comes to you know, not necessarily here in North America, but across the world, pollination, seed dispersal for rainforest, you know, the list kind of goes on as far as the ecosystem functions that they perform and help rid pests, mosquitoes, you know, spruce budworm, things like that that have real impacts on crops and our forest industry. You know, bats are and birds are really the first line of defense for a lot of these things.
We talked about the white nose syndrome and how it's believed by some that 80 to 90% of the bat population in Maine has declined. Some studies say up to 96%. Are we hopeful that they can come back? I know that we've talked about these talus cliffs. Is this sort of grasping at one small thing, or is there a real belief that the white nose syndrome, you know, that maybe the bats, certain bats are strong enough to resist it, and 10, 20 years from now, we'll see a big population again?
So you had a lot of questions in there. See if I can answer each of them. So we have 8 different species of bats in Maine. Some of those are migratory, so they leave in the winter and head south. And those are the species that are not affected by white nose syndrome. They're not congregating in these large numbers in cavities or caves. Our resident bats here in Maine are the ones in the bat caves and the ones that have been severely affected. So taken collectively, you know, it's hard to estimate how much our bat population has declined over time. We can say that we know from our surveys in the winter, we can say that those numbers have declined by, you know, approximately 95%. So this winter, we're going to go back into the bat caves. We haven't been there since 2016. We're not visiting those caves annually like we used to because we don't want to have any additional disturbance to those bats. Just a person walking into a bat cave can cause bats to wake up. And when they're in torpor, so that's that deep sleep that they're in the winter, it's a very slow wake up. So you may not notice those bats are going to wake up quickly and fly all around. Just a single person walking into a cave could you know, make those bats wake up, fly around, and then use up their energy reserves. So we actually, in 2015, we passed a new rule. So no human entry is allowed into bat hibernacula in the state of Maine during the wintertime.
And so, you've been blocking them off, right, Dave?
Well, the state of Maine with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, I think, basically, yeah, have gated two?
We gated one. We gated our largest. Yeah, we gated our largest in July of 2018. It was a lot of heavy lifting, a lot of steel.
Yeah, and a lot of work.
We put a permanent gate in place, so it prevents people from entering that cave.
Right, someone going in there just for exploring, so some kids to go in might cause some real damage. I know, Dave, when you and I went in, we were all suited up, and so we wouldn't spread any germs. Is there any way to sort of post maybe cameras that you could, wildlife cameras or something, to get an idea of what's going on in there without going in at all?
That can be a little bit more difficult. You know, it's it's not always easy to get the coming and going. And then, you know, a lot of these caves are in really remote places. So, you know, you're talking about connectivity to the internet or things like that. So you're still actually spending a trip going out there and a lot of time. It's probably more efficient to go in and just count who's there. And also with video and photography and things like that, you're not going to get species and things like that. Or the health of the bats. Is there actually white nose on the bat in the winter? You know, things that you actually can just see with your eyes. You know, I think Chevenot is right. You have to minimize disturbance. But if you're going in every other year, every 3-4 years, I think that's reasonable to at least get an idea of where things are at.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing what you all find this winter. We are going to take a quick break. We're talking about Maine's bat population. Your comments and questions when we come back. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from AARP Maine, working to lower prescription drug costs. Learn more at aarp.org/rx. And Damariscotta River Grill, celebrating 16 years of serving grown-up comfort food, open year-round on Main Street in Damariscotta. DamariscottaRiverGrill.com.
Under pressure from the Trump administration, Mexico has stepped up deportations of migrants along its southern border.
En la frontera sur de México, que sirve como...
The southern border of Mexico has become the most effective wall Donald Trump wanted.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. More on the immigration crackdown this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. A special thanks to Rhonda of Randolph, Maine, for her donation of a 2002 Jeep Grand Cherokee. Donations to the Maine Public Car Donation Program make a big difference for your public radio station and in most cases result in a tax deduction for you. Towing is free, and the great feeling you get from supporting the programming that you enjoy and count on is priceless. If you're wondering what to do with your car, please consider Maine Public. It's easy. Just go to mainepublic.org, click on support, and then the Maine Public Vehicle Donation Program. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the bat population in Maine, what's being done to protect them and what you need to know about being around bats. Joining me, Dave Yates, a wildlife biologist with the Biodiversity Research Institute. Mark King is a bat biologist and organics management specialist with Maine DEP. And Chevenel Webb is a small mammal biologist with Maine's Department of IF&W. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to start with an email. This is from Dawn. Just a few nights ago, I was listening to a riveting story about rabies. It was stated that bats carry rabies, and a bat can bite you while you're sleeping, and you can't feel it, nor can you see the tiny bite marks. Do bats carry rabies, and is it true what was said about not feeling or seeing a bite by a bat? I, too, have heard that if you are bitten by a bat in your sleep, you may not feel it or ever know that that happened. Chevenel, you have some new information.
So we do know that bats carry rabies, and that's something to be taken seriously. And that is true that, you know, they are small and they have a small mouth, so you could be bitten or scratched and not realize that. And to kind of put it in reference, we get about approximately 200 bats each year annually that are submitted in Maine that have had a potential exposure to people or pets. And so of those 200 bats submitted, approximately 8 come back positive for rabies. So that's about 4%. And those bats that typically are in people's houses are mostly rabies negative. So the good news is if you find a bat in your home, maybe it's an attic or a basement, it's not in a living space, it's not in a bedroom, it's not found in a room with a child or someone who may be intoxicated or someone who may be handicapped and not be able to communicate with you that they've seen a bat or maybe a bat had landed on them, we always recommend testing that bat for rabies just to be on the safe side. So in general, the advice is if you find it in your house, you know, you come home from work and you find a bat flying around in your living room, it's oftentimes safe to let that go, to open your window, open a door, watch that bat exit. However, if you find that your dog picks up a bat from outside and, you know, is playing with it, that's a potential exposure, and you need to follow up with that.
What if you see a bat flying in the middle of the day?
That can happen in the summer. People find baby bats in particular, which is not always a cause for concern. We do find, too, in the later summer when the days get really hot and those pups are starting to learn how to fly. They're not great flyers. Sometimes they can fall out of their nest. And so you can sometimes find bats during the day.
And I want to make note that you just called the bat, young bat, a pup, just like a pup dog. I love that. We're going to go to Lori calling from Denmark, Maine. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I'm happy to report that bats are alive and well here in Denmark, Maine. We have a lot of them. But secondly, a few years back, I served on a committee here in Denmark to form a wind ordinance committee. And the gentleman from Kennebunk who helped us with that process stated that bats really like to congregate on the bases of those turbines, and that when they come on, it can actually mean instant death for the bats who are on that. So it was a really sobering kind of thought about wind turbines and whether or not I support them, but I just wondered if anyone on your panel could speak to that.
I think that's an important thing to bring up, and thank you, Lori. There's been some research, correct, about bats and wind turbines. You want to hit it, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably maybe what she's referring to is there's a study, maybe a little less than a decade ago or less, and it was by Paul Cryon, kind of a bat researcher, and he had suggested that the biggest tree in the woods was attracting the bats. The migratory bats, the red bat, the silver-haired, and the hoary bat, congregate. They have what's called a lek, and basically the male sets up over the best territory in the woods, and all the females will come and mate with the male. That's a theory. I think that might be what she's referring to. I don't know if that really ever got fleshed out. That was more just kind of a theory that was put out there. I think there might be some validity to it, but you know, we don't know exactly what's attracting these bats to the wind, to the wind turbines.
It is true the bats seem to be attracted to wind turbines
in certain areas. Yeah, it definitely seems like that is a possibility. But to what end, we don't know. And it's hard because, we have a lot of questions ourselves. We don't know the populations of those specific bats because they never go to caves. So we can't sit there and count them. We don't know where their populations really are at. We don't know a lot of things about these guys because they're small, cryptic, night-dwelling mammals that are flying and places that are hard for us to get. At the end of the day, it's really hard to answer a lot of these questions. But, I would say in Maine, Maine's very progressive in their stance on wind power. And what they do is called curtailment. And basically it's well documented that once wind speeds get below a certain meters per second, bats really like to fly and migrate. And what happens is Maine IFNW basically has regulations in place that says that they have to curtail their wind power to avoid possibly a collision with a bat.
So if the wind is at a speed, Chevanel, at which a bat wants to migrate, wind turbines are shut down.
Yeah, so put it in layman's terms, basically bats like to fly when there's low winds and no precipitation and relatively warm temperatures. So when you have those conditions, you're more likely to have the bats being active. And so we've had a lot of research studies that has looked at, when mortalities are occurring seasonally. And you can definitely see, during those active periods of time, we see more mortality. And there's peak mortality time, which is that migratory time, which is like August and September in particular. So at low wind speeds, turbines can be shut down. And there's also, in addition to looking just at the wind speed, you can have deterrents on there as well. that can kind of jam the system of that bats are using to echolocate. There's a lot of great research that's happening right now to reduce the mortality of bats at wind farms.
That's really cutting edge right now is the deterrent or something to keep the bats away. We think that we're attracting them somehow, so maybe using UV light, using sound, something to keep the bats away from the turbines when they're spinning.
We have an email from Danielle. Just a few months ago, NPR had a show talking about the decline of insects in the state of Maine over the past 5 to 8 years. That was us. Could this have anything to do with the bat decline along with white nose fungus? Danielle, I had the same question.
Yeah, probably. For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the report was out in Biological Conservation showing a 40% drop in the insect population in the world.
Yeah, I mean, these buggers eat, 1,000, 2,000 bugs per bat per night, especially black flies and mosquitoes. And if that
populate... Wait, 1,000 to 2,000 bugs per night?
Correct. And they feed twice in an evening. They go out and have their first feeding, usually from dusk till about midnight. Then they night roost to digest, and then they have a second feeding before they go back to their colony in the morning.
Amazing.
When I studied mine in 86 in southern Illinois, I actually caught them coming back at 3 in the morning. So it's pretty neat to watch them fly back into a house. They come in huge hordes.
So they say bats can eat their weight in insects each night. So I think most of us can get on board with that's a good thing.
Yeah. Mm, yeah.
And if people, want to try to help, I think it's always interesting to put a plug in for, really reducing the chemicals that you're using on your lawn and your gardens. Because that affects the insects, which in turn affects other wildlife species. So if there's any way to reduce pesticide use and other chemicals that we use, in those areas, that's a wonderful thing.
Larvicides, pesticides, any of that stuff can really play a big role in what's out there for them to eat. And it's not always, something that there might be a lot of targets out there for them, but not a lot of targets that are nutritiously rich for them. It might be one of those pitfalls where you're getting a lot of these insects, but nutritiously, these insects are better.
We'll go to Elizabeth calling from Sydney, Maine. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to share a quick story of when I was a kid. I was the first pickup on the school bus, and we got on about 7:15 in the morning, and it was in the fall, and we had about maybe 3 people on the bus at that time, and a bat flew on the school bus, and the bus driver took off his hat to sort of swat at it, and it was flying up and down the bus, and it landed on the back of his head, and he was half bald, and it was flapping around, and there were 3 or 4 of us just hysterical. And so then he got up, and he started yelling to us in his thick French accent to open up all the windows. So we could hardly even do that because we were all laughing so hard. And I think I was maybe only like about 9. And so we got all the windows open and got the bat out, and it just completely made our day. And it's something I will never forget.
Nice.
That's a funny story. That would have been an exposure for your bus driver. I hope he made it okay.
Oh, my gosh, Elizabeth, thank you for calling and sharing that. We'll go to Sylvia, who's calling from Weston. Hi, Sylvia. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to tell you about my bat story, and that is a very simple way to keep bats out of your attic or any place, your basement. You just leave a light on for 24 hours a day. I had a 3-story barn right next to the house, not more than 15 feet away, and it eventually fell apart, and the bats were still finding a way to make a home in there. And after it was taken down is when I found a bat in my attic. And all I did was put a light bulb with an extension cord up there, and they were gone. Within 3 days, there was no bat to be seen. And they didn't try going into 2 other buildings that are on the property. And I have recommended it to people at the local hospital, who one of them was having so many problems with it, with everything he was trying. And I said, just leave the lights on 24 hours a day, and it works. You don't have to get into anything else. The bats will leave.
Thoughts, Mark?
Well, I've had mixed results with that. I work for a museum that had bats in their attic, and I found that they kept the light on 24/7, but they had a lot of beams, and the bats just went to the shadowy side of the beam and would roost away from the light. So if you have an open attic, that might definitely work, but if you have a lot of wooden structures for the bats to hide behind, then they're going to be able to hide their eyes from the light, and it would work well. And the other thing that I don't believe works, and they sell a ton of them, are those sonic devices. They pick a frequency that's supposed to drive the bats crazy, but most of the time it's not even a frequency that's within their acoustic range, so it just doesn't work.
Chavanel?
Some other advice is if you're, you know, we don't expect people to live with bats. If you're going to exclude bats from your home and you're going to do it outside of those summer months, what's recommended is putting up a bat house before you exclude those bats. So they have somewhere to go. Yep. You'd rather them, you know, that was an example maybe where the barn was taken down. That's where the bats were using. So before excluding a bat, you know, make sure that you've got an alternative, safe place for them to go.
All right. Well, our producer Cindy was told, and tell us if this is right, that that bat houses are more popular among male bats than female bats.
That's really interesting, but the ones that I build or that we designed in 86 are really big. And the idea was that we had an inner panel or partition so that the front was facing south and was really warm because the pregnant females need the heat to help speed up their metabolism and gestation of the baby. And
so make it big.
Make it big and have it so that it's right in the sun and you have a warm chamber. And then I would have a back chamber that was cooler for the adult males to go into. But usually what happens is once a male does his job in the fall, they go to different places to rest in the spring and summer. They tend to be excluded away from the females. The females cluster together and they have their young. But the males and surprisingly the females that didn't get pregnant tend to roost together. At least that's what I found in my study in Illinois.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is all great information. We do need to take another quick break. We're talking about bats on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you want to send an email, send it quickly and make it brief to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com.
Hello, I'm Jane Wales, host of World Affairs. Escalating tensions between the U.S. and China may have long-term consequences for both countries. Next on World Affairs, David Lampton, a fellow at the Freeman Spohley Institute of Stanford University, joins us to take a closer look at the growing rivalry and what steps Beijing and Washington can take to move in a more productive direction.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Are you a regular listener to Morning Edition? When you miss it, do you wish there was some way you could still hear it, even if it's not on the radio? Well, now you can if you have an Alexa smart speaker. Just say, "Smart speaker, please play Morning Edition." Alexa will then ask you which station you want to hear, and you, of course, will say Maine Public Radio. And then Alexa will play back the last full hour of Morning Edition. So you can hear the most recent hour of Morning Edition with Irwin Gratz until 3 each afternoon. At this point in time, this is for only Alexa smart speakers. We'll let you know if Google Home learns how to do this. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the bat population in Maine. Joining me, Mark King with the Department of Environmental Protection, Chavanel Webb with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Dave Yates with the Biodiversity Research Institute. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Sue, I really appreciate the information, especially when to address this issue in one's home. And here's her question. With bats found in an attic and the need to clean guano, do I need to wear a respirator and gloves?
No, the answer is no. But what I do when I go up there is I use a vacuum that has a HEPA filter because it's really not the general activity that causes the dust. It's the vacuum sort of blasting the exhaust out, and what the HEPA filter does is it captures the material, but it doesn't mean you have to go out and buy a special vac. There are ones that you can rent from the local hardware store that are just considered to be an industrial vac. What happens is a lot of companies do these kind of services and charge a huge amount of money for it, but there are others that will do it for a very reasonable rate. And so the smart advice is to do some good shopping.
All right. We'll go to Margie calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Oh, my goodness. I couldn't believe you have a bat story. Anyway, a couple years back, I was watching TV, and I have cathedral ceilings, and all of a sudden I hear something flying around and going into the wall because I have one high wall. And I'm looking. I'm going, oh, my God, it's a bat. And there were two of them. I'm going, oh, my God. And I'm thinking they're going to suck my blood or something. I can't go to sleep. I got to get them out. And so I had this strainer-like, and I said, well, if I put this strainer over them, but I couldn't reach them. So I went out, and this is night now. I got a long pole, and I taped it to the strainer, and I was waiting until they calmed down. And then I put it over it, and then I pulled it slowly down, and then I put a cardboard in back. Meanwhile, I had my sliding glass door open, and I let them out. And then I had to do the second one. Oh, my God, I'll tell you. It was scary. But, you know, they're not that bad.
No, they're not that bad. And Margie, scared. Did you see them fly away? Are you pretty certain you were able to get them out of your house uninjured?
Yeah. Oh, they weren't hurt or nothing? No. I was able to get them, and then I opened it up, and they flew out. Yeah.
Mark?
Yeah, I saved the two of them. But, oh, my God, I was by myself, so I didn't have anybody to help me, you know. That was funny.
Oh, this is great. Thanks for calling and telling the story, Margie. Dave? Mark.
This is a question I get all the time. And if you get a bat in your house, the first thing to do is to isolate it into one room. So if you can close the door off to the room, then go to the other side of the room and open the windows, preferably from the top down on one side. Turn the lights on and just gently with a broom or some device, keep the bat flying, and they will eventually echolocate the opening and leave because they don't want to be there any more than you want them there.
Okay. And they can find the opening on their
own.
They
sure can.
Great. We'll go to Charlotte calling from Somerville. Hi, Charlotte. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a question. I was wondering if any fungicide has been discovered that will heal white nose syndrome. And if yes, has it been tried like as a spray or a powder at the entryways of the caves or anything like that?
So there's currently no cure for the fungus. It remains in the environment for a really long time, but there's lots of research and lots of promising results in the lab. I know one of the things that they're trying is something that like yogurt to kill the fungus,
yep.
Special lights. So there's a lot of different
UV
things
lights.
Being tested right now.
It's tough, though. You know, you're talking about a cave, right, with crevices and cracks and things like that. So, you know, how do you treat those bats that are in these tiny little, you know, we don't even know some of them are even there because they're jammed up in these little cracks and crevices and things like that. So that, you know, that's one hard
and
thing.
And they're tiny.
They're tiny.
Especially little browns.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then on top of that, there are beneficial funguses and things like that in the cave as well. So you can't just go in and obliterate an ecosystem when you're just trying to save one other thing. I think we've learned those lessons from the past. So, you know, I think we have to be careful about our approach on a lot of this.
All right, Charlotte, thanks for your call. Do we know, I know that you said you haven't gone into these hibernacula in several years. Do we know if the decline has evened out at all? If, you know, there was those years where we just saw that precipitous decline in the bat population. Has it continued at that same pace or do we even know?
I think it's hard to speculate whether we continue to decline or we've stabilized, but what the trends we're seeing here in Maine are very similar to the other northeastern states. Vermont has potentially seen a stabilization happening, so we're hopeful that that has happened here as well. And this winter, after we do our winter survey, we're hoping to see similar, if not maybe a bump in numbers from the previous survey in 2016 and 2013 that you were on, Jennifer.
All right. So we'll go to Clara, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Clara. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking this call. This is a great show. So my husband and I retired onto Falmouth in the early summer and found our new little retirement place tucked in. It's a great little oasis. And the previous owners had installed a very high pole with a large, black plastic bat house. And I believe one side is actually facing south, but there appears to have never been bats there. So my question, is it realistic to try to figure out how to attract? We would love to have bats come to this bat house. And how might we invite that?
What do you do, Mark? Do you put a sign up? Open?
It's very hit or miss. With the population declines that we've experienced, it's even harder. But one of the things that I do when I go to places that, and we exclude the bats, is we put up bat houses, and I usually take some of the guano, and I rub it inside with a mixture of water, and I rub it inside because for some reason they like that smell, and that often will get some bats to get in there. But they fly by it, they land on it, and they
How might
smell
Clara
it.
Get her hands on some bat guano?
Believe it or not, they sell it at Paris Farmers Union and some of the other hardware stores. It's
oh
a
goodness.
Very rich fertilizer, and she could easily use it to make an attractant.
There you go, Claire. Good luck to you. We'll go to Megan calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Megan. Go ahead.
Oh.
Go
Can
ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. So the year is 1981. I'm in Atlantic City sitting in my girlfriend's living room watching the silent movie Dracula, setting the stage. As he's ready to bite her neck, a bat flies through her living room.
That's so, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So I go into her kitchen. I get every single pot and pan she owns, and I sit down in the floor and with the pots and pans all around me and finish movie. And she comes in and she sees me with all these pots and pans around me, and she goes, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "There's a bat in the house." And she goes, "No, there's not. You're just watching a movie. You imagined it." So she goes in her bedroom, closes the door. The bat comes back out from wherever it was, and I run into her bedroom and I said, "The bat's back." And she goes, "No, Megan." And she opens her door. The bat flies right at her. She screams, "There's a bat in the house." I'm like, "Yeah."
Oh, my goodness.
We eventually got it out, but it was just that was my Dracula bat story.
Cool.
Well, inappropriate for this week. And I think earlier I said that tomorrow is Halloween. No, the day after tomorrow is Halloween. Thank you, Megan, for your call. We're going to go to Andrew, who's calling from Union. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Couple of things. One, the Union area. I used to see bats all the time in the evening outside. I haven't seen them in a long time. Are there any areas like has Union been especially hard hit? And
no. Statewide. Statewide.
It is just statewide.
Actually, forget about statewide. It's region wide.
Yeah.
Truly. And there are some pockets.
Tons of them.
Yeah, there are pockets still where you could get into them. But
yeah.
They're few and far between. For sure.
We did have the caller from Denmark who said there are bats there, but I know that Acadia National Park is a place where the seen a precipitous decline.
We have, but that is still a place where you could go and actually, you know, so in the summer, you know, I'll go out and miss net bats and, you know, pre-white nose, we'd catch anywhere, say, from 30 to 50 bats a night. Post-white nose, in Acadia, we could catch maybe like 5 to 10, which, you know, is really good. I did a project in New Hampshire this last summer, and there were plenty of nights where we didn't catch any bats. And, you know, again, before white nose, there's, you know, well, we have documentation that, you know, they had caught bats in those places and the species that we were looking for, but they're just not there, unfortunately.
So. We probably ought to tell them to which species don't get white nose or not prone to it. You mentioned the three that migrate, the tree bats, the red bat, the hoary bat, and the silver-haired. But I also believe that the big browns tend to roost nearer the cave opening, so they're not as prone to get it as well.
They're not as susceptible, but they definitely have shown white nose. And you know, I think their population has declined, I think, on the order of 30 to 50%. It's kind of harder to tell, you know, where some of these populations decline 99%.
Yeah, and the bigger the bat is, the more energy reserves it has. So I think that really impacts things as well, the smaller you are.
Yeah. That definitely has something to do with it. And then I think you're right, Mark. I think where you are in the hibernacula, and small-footeds are our smallest North American bat and tend to roost, you know, when we go on the hibernaculas, you'll see them right at the front, and it's this little icicle-covered bat, and you're like, whoa, that an icicle? No, that's a bat. And it's a small-footed. And for whatever reason, they really like to roost in these places, and maybe that makes it, you know, inhospitable for the fungus as well, and can really.
You know, I know a lot of people listening to the program really care about the bats. We were talking about bat houses. Do bat houses, in theory, help the bat population? Yes, they do.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Because they provide an alternative place for them to go. But what happens is people will put the house up, you know, within 10 or 15 feet of their house without doing any exclusion work, when their attic is a much better bat house. So when you put the bat houses out, it should be in conjunction with getting rid of the openings in your own house. But there's a company down in Missouri called Brandon Bark that makes one of the coolest bat houses that I've ever seen. It's a sort of a plastic bark, and inside it has a mesh that the bats can cling to. And they put it on telephone poles and other poles in the middle of swamps. And these bat species go in, and they've had huge success with them.
Yeah, they had huge success at Fort Knox, where all our gold is, and and it's a huge hibernacula, maternity colony for Indiana bats, what are federally endangered bats down there. And it's amazing. It's one of the places you could still go, although I haven't, I don't know, I haven't checked in the last couple of years, but it was one of the places you could still go and see large numbers of Indiana bats, and that bark. Right. Really had a big, it was a mitigation work for some of the work that was being done on the base.
And we have someone named Jimmy on Facebook who has posted that he makes a company that makes bat boxes, batbnb.com. So he likes those. An email from Katie. I'm a little disappointed to hear a previous caller advocating leaving lights on 24 hours a day. In addition to the environmental consequences of excessive electricity use, lights at night attract insects, many of whom then die from impacts with the bulbs. So, you know, sometimes solutions are problematic. And we're going to end with this one, an email from Jane. We once found a live bat inside our Roomba vacuum. Any idea how or why they might have been in there? Anybody want to answer that in just a few seconds?
They were hiding under the couch. I found when people call me and say they had a bat in their house, but they can't find it, it'll be in the couch cushions. Under the couch. And the Roomba probably sucked it up.
Yeah.
Okay, then. Well, thank you guys so much. Obviously, such interest in the bat population in Maine. I mean, they really are magical watching them swoop around and scoop up the insects at a summer night at dusk. Our guest tonight, Chevanelle Webb, fur bearer and small mammal biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Dave Yates, wildlife research biologist at Biodiversity Research Institute. And Mark King, a bat biologist and bat exclusion expert, who is an organics management specialist with the Department of Environmental Protection. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.